In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Naomi Wolf. She's a feminist writer. She's probably best known for her first book, published in 1990, titled The Beauty Myth, How Images of Beauty Are Used Against Women, in which she makes the basic argument that the expectations we have of women in regards to their appearance actually is a way of controlling them. She has written a number of other books. She's also written for The New Republic, Wall Street Journal, Esquire, Washington Post, New York Times, just to mention a few. Her other books include Fire with Fire, The New Female Power and How It Will Change the 21st Century. That was published in 1993. And Promiscuities, The Secret Struggle for Womanhood, published in 1997. Her new book is about, at least in part, about her experiences with pregnancy and motherhood. It's been out now just a couple of months. The title is Misconceptions, Truth, Lies, and the Unexpected on the Journey to Motherhood. It's published by Doubleday. In addition to her writing and speaking, she is a co-founder of the Woodhull Institute for Ethical Leadership. This is an organization that's interested in training young women in ethical leadership for the 21st century. It teaches professional development in a number of areas: arts, media, politics, law, business, and so on. Naomi Wolf talking with us this morning by telephone. As we do, questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. One thing we ask, the only thing we ask, really, of people who call in is that they just try to keep their comments brief. We ask that so we can get in as many different people as possible and keep the program moving along. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, you'd like to call in, 333-9455. That's the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Ms. Wolf, hello.
Yes. Hi, hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm so glad to be able to.
It seems that that your intent with this book is to do two things. In part, there are a number of comments from different women that you talk to that are in the book that talking about their aspects of pregnancy and birthing and the early phases of motherhood that all seem to be saying essentially one sort of thing, and that is, nobody told me it was going to be like this.
Mm.
So that it seems that in part it's an attempt to say, based on your experience and some other women's experience, this is how it is, but also that it's a shot at the way, as a society, we also approach ideas like and realities like pregnancy and motherhood and so forth. Do you see the book as sort of primarily being one or the other, as either a policy piece or a memoir, or was it really your intention to try to do both?
Well, with each of my books, as my readers know, I do try to do both. I really believe that there are truths about women's life experiences that you only get at by really listening respectfully to women and also by exploring your own experience. And so I do have the voices of a number of pregnant women, women who have gone through fertility treatments, women who've gone through miscarriage, women who had experiences of pregnancy that were deeper than they anticipated in various ways, as well as experiences of women going through the birth process, which you're right to say I'm very, very critical of, because there are things very wrong with how American hospitals encourage women to give birth. But behind all of that, I do try to peel back the forces, the bigger picture forces, that are influencing how these personal experiences unfold. And I certainly do take my own experience as one point of departure. I had a wonderful baby girl 6 years ago, now a big girl. And while motherhood is the best thing that ever happened to me, I definitely had the experience that many women did on the journey of pregnancy, that it was a much more psychologically challenging experience than the books I read prepared me for. Mm. And I also definitely had a very common experience, many of the women I interviewed went through it, of having a traumatic but very ordinary birth, an ordinary bad birth, and postpartum depression. And so I do take each of these touch points as an entry for looking at why so many women in America experience similar challenges on the journey to new motherhood.
And you now have two children?
Yes, we have a little guy named Joey. He is an adorable 21 months old at just that kind of squishable stage. Mm. Yes.
Well, I just I raised that question, and you here have touched on it, but I just want to make sure that people who are listening understand that that if you had to do it over again, you would still have your children.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
You wouldn't.
That's
okay.
That happened to us. Okay. Absolutely. But saying, I mean, there are taboos against speaking honestly about new motherhood, and one of the ways a taboo works is that you're really encouraged to not express any sadness or ambivalence or reaction to trauma on the journey to motherhood, because it is such a gift, and it is such a gift to have a baby. But unfortunately, when we drive those experiences underground and say you're not allowed to, or give new moms or pregnant women the message that you're really not allowed to express anything but just unmitigated joy and anticipation and fulfillment, I think that we paradoxically create the conditions for the extremely high rates of postpartum depression and the tough adjustment that, you know, many millions of women and new dads have to new parenthood. Let me just give you one example. Let's start with pregnancy. When you are reading pregnancy books, you do get the picture that it's a time of nothing but, you know, blissful anticipation. And that's certainly true. It's also a time, though, when you are saying goodbye to an old self, you know, a self that was free, that was autonomous, that was able to make decisions really for yourself. And you need to mourn that lost young woman self as you get ready to take on this huge responsibility of becoming a mother. The experience of pregnancy also brings women face to face with some very challenging moments about what they believe. For instance, I am pro-choice. At 3 months, I saw a sonogram of our baby. As a pro-choice woman, that experience forced me to delve more deeply into my understanding of what a profound moral decision it is to terminate a pregnancy. And it forces you to recognize how serious that decision is. I still believe women should have that decision, but that was a much bigger life and death kind of moment of thinking, God, you know, this shakes up my easy expectations than I'd been prepared for. Another example is, David, at 7 months, I was startled to find that my personality was really changing, and many women I interviewed expressed the same thing, and that you really do become kind of more kind and more emotional and, you know, less interested in political debate and more wanting to just sort of hug small children and sit in a corner and eat and, you know, cuddle cats. And I mean, these very traditionally feminine behaviors. And as a feminist, it startled me to find how much of my personality was altered by what were, in fact, hormonal changes taking place in my body. So these are, you know, deep things to grapple with. And that is just a foretaste of the profound challenges that women face once they go to the labor room in the United States and once they enter into the hospital experience.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, one of the things that you touch on, and is certainly the case, in spite of the fact that it seems that we talk more and more about the need for something that we might call parent education. You know, that is the idea that there are things that we need to teach people about what it means to be a parent. At the same time, we still seem not to be able to shake this idea that being a mother is something that is almost, that's supposed to be in a woman at a genetic level, that it just comes with being a woman, and that means that you're automatically going to know everything to do. And that's just sort of silly, but yet we can't seem to shake it.
Well, it goes very deep. We really want to believe that, you know, as I put it in the book, that mothering is effortless, like, you know, apples falling from a tree or, you know, cows calving in the spring. I mean, we really want to believe that it's so deeply a part of what we come equipped with as women that it's natural. But in fact, this is one of the reasons so many women feel overwhelmed when they actually become new mothers, because while the biological drive and the bonding is, you know, evolutionarily hardwired into us, it also takes support, and it takes emotional support, and it takes teaching, and it takes many ways of respecting the daily challenge and effort and will that goes into being a good mother or a good father that we really aren't ready to acknowledge. And that's why so many women do feel, when they are overwhelmed, that they are failures rather than understanding. I mean, I found it personally liberating in this book to find that the ways in which we expect new mothers to cope are actually very unnatural. They're culturally unnatural. They're historically unnatural. Very few societies, apart from ours for the last 200 years, expect new moms to take a baby home and be primarily responsible for it for most of the day. And we have a 1 in 2 rate of postpartum depression in America. The isolation, that lack of other hands to kind of comfort the new mother, look after the new mother, make sure the new mother is not having to do additional work, additional housework, looking after other kids. Other cultures mother the new mother intensively for the first 40 days and make sure that all she has to do is lie in bed and bond with her baby and nurse her baby, fall in love with her baby. And we don't do that with new mothers. And really, we expect two pairs of hands to be able to manage. And that is so overwhelming and so, in a sense, recent an expectation that I found it a huge relief, and other women who have read Misconceptions also find it a relief, to know that if they can't cope with that easily, it's not because they are bad moms. It's not because they are dysfunctional. It's because it really is overwhelming to expect new mothers, especially after the traumatic birth that many millions of women have, to be able to go home and do it all themselves with so little emotional support and other hands passing the baby around. I talked, David, about ordinary bad births, and I really would love to spell out for listeners what I'm describing, because sure, many people might be mystified as to why I would feel so strongly about this, except new moms probably won't, but I imagine many people who work in the health professions might want to have a say about this. What I mean is that 90% of women in America give birth in hospitals. And in hospitals, unfortunately, in spite of 25 years of criticism about how increasingly medicalized and almost industrialized the birth experience has become, things are worse than ever. Hospital birth has become more and more like agribusiness, in which your labor cycle and your management of the labor is speeded up artificially in ways that are dangerous to you and the baby, not because best practice medical care calls for it, but really, David, because this kind of speeding up is most convenient and most profitable for hospitals as an institution. And there are also legal pressures on obstetricians to encourage them to intervene and speed up labor in ways that are dangerous for women. And I'd love to give you a few examples of that if you'd like to go there.
Sure. Well, I tell you what, let me just real quick here, for anybody who might have tuned in, I'd like to reintroduce you so people will know who it is that they're listening to, and then we can continue. Our guest this morning is Naomi Wolf. She's the author of a number of books, and as I mentioned at the beginning, probably best known for her first book, The Beauty Myth. Her newest book is about, in part, about her experiences with pregnancy and motherhood, and the experiences of other women as well. The title of the book is Misconceptions, Truth, Lies, and the Unexpected on the Journey to Motherhood. And it's published by Doubleday, and questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. You certainly, you do in beginning, after you find out that you're pregnant and then go out there looking for care, you did seem to have a tough time finding a doctor that you would be happy with, and it seemed, a lot of it did seem to be, at least to you, very important issues about who was in charge. Is it you or is it the doctor? And also, there seemed to be you seem to be really concerned about trying to do everything that you could to avoid a C-section, which, and I know there are a lot of doctors and there's an OBGYN who's on this program every month, and we've been talking about this for a long time. I know that there are some doctors who are concerned that there are way too many of them,
yeah,
and there still continue to be a lot of them.
Yeah.
And so that was something that you were, and ultimately you ended up having one, but it was something that you really seemed to feel really strongly about wanting to try to avoid.
Well, you know, Most women want to do what they can to have a non-surgical birth. I actually feel like cesarean sections are really a godsend for those, 6 to 17% of births that require, surgical resolution, because there is a real problem. What I discovered after having had a very traumatic but perfectly ordinary cesarean section is that there are forces in place in an ordinary hospital birth that make it much more likely that you will have an unnecessary cesarean section, and that is one of the things I am distressed about. In America, one woman in four is going to have a cesarean section, and the numbers go up if you're having a second baby, because it's considered unsafe to try to have a second baby without a cesarean section by many practices. But the World Health Organization is appalled at how high America's rates of cesarean surgery are, and says that optimally, again, it would be in the single digits, or 12 to 17%. So that's just one of the things that are happening to women that don't have to do with actually what's best for them and their babies. Let me give you an example of how there's like a cascade of interventions that goes into place that leads to traumatic experiences in hospitals for new moms. When you go to an American hospital, you are encouraged to lie down. That's very common. This is so ordinary, it's almost unremarkable in America. Other countries that have much better outcomes for mothers and babies are horrified that we do this barbaric thing to women, because they know that, in fact, the most excruciating position in which to labor is lying down in a bed. Not only is it excruciating, thus leading you to call for an epidural, thus making forceps delivery more likely, thus making cesarean more likely, et cetera, but it actually forces the baby to try to move up the birth canal against gravity in order to be born. What's actually best for women and babies is if mothers are encouraged to move around and do very unladylike things in labor, to lunge, to squat, to pull on the furniture, to pull on their husbands or partners, to pull on the staff, to make guttural tiger sounds. But I discovered belatedly that the birthing class you're likely to go to is not going to teach you this, because it's likely that you can't know that the person teaching it is actually paid by the hospital. And they're teaching you ladylike huffing sounds lying on your back, because this is actually more convenient for hospitals and more convenient for hospital staff to have you be in excruciating pain and in a position that's bad for the baby, but that's more effortless for them than having you making tiger sounds in the hallways and pulling on the staff. So this was something that was very disturbing to me to discover. It's true, too, that the birthing industry, David, has evolved in such a way that it's produced like new fake cosmetic overlays to appeal to women like me and my readers, that is, women who want to be self-educated, self-empowered, and take responsibility for their birth. There are midwives who are kind of the entry point for midwife obstetrical practices, who really have no power. This is what happened to me. Women and men flock to them thinking, oh, the best of both worlds, but they're not told that, in fact, the midwives are helpless to intervene if the doctors do things that they think are unnecessary or destructive. There are birthing centers across America, like the one that I tried to give birth in, which are really fake birthing centers, equipped with a recliner and a jacuzzi and beautiful beds and, no technology visibly there in a hospital, so there's backup technologically if there's a problem. What you're not told is that this is a marketing lure, and that a tiny minority of women actually manage to give birth there, that in fact this gets you to sign on to that hospital, but at the first sign of anything that would allow them to shunt you downstairs to the high-tech birthing rooms, they do so without giving you a trial of labor. So these are very cynical practices. Epidurals. If you read What to Expect When You're Expecting, which is the pregnancy Bible, an epidural seems like an obvious choice. Do you want to have agonizing labor or labor without pain? But what you're not told is that for every hour you're on an epidural, your chance of maternal fever goes up in the double digits, and that the drugs make it much more likely you'll have trouble bonding and nursing. Cesarean section, you mentioned, and it's true, our rates are astronomical. But why is that? The average obstetrician wants to put a laboring woman on a fetal monitor because it gives him or her a defense legally in case there is a lawsuit. But the truth is that after decades of study, electronic fetal monitors are shown to have no benefit in predicting the well-being of the baby. The one effect they do have is to raise the rates of cesarean section. But doctors and hospitals like them for legal reasons. So even though it keeps you on your back and interferes with your labor and really makes it more likely you'll be cut unnecessarily surgically, you're going to be strapped to a fetal monitor in many places. And finally, cesarean sections peak before weekends and holidays. Doctors make $1,000 more for a surgical birth than they do for a vaginal birth. And the numbers are so high because, again, because doctors and hospitals have a profit motive to not give women a real trial of labor. There's this constant pressure on hospitals to clear the board, why is your patient still there? And surgical births are easier to process through than healthy, normal vaginal births. And the last example of this really quite horrifying business model of birth that really makes American birth so damaging to many women and dangerous to babies. We're 18 out of 21 worst on the scale of outcomes for mothers and babies with all our technology, is episiotomies. For those of you who don't know, an episiotomy is an incision in the perineum. About 6% of women need episiotomies in Europe, where they know how to support the perineum with massage. But in some practices in America, about 60% of women are going to have an episiotomy. If you read What to Expect, a book I'm really hard on, they really treat it like a minor routine cut. In fact, it's a major incision into muscle that can lead women with sexual response problems up to years after the birth. But doctors like it because it's faster, not because it's safer. The tear that you're often scared away from ever risking is most often a superficial tear in tissue. So these are all practices that are really quite traumatic for women, and that many, many obstetricians have told me after having read the book, really they would love to not have to do. They say we need to reform the system. We don't want to practice medicine this way. This is not the best way to give a healthy birth to mothers and babies. And I do believe that these traumatic interventions are one of the reasons that new moms really often go home feeling like they were hit by a truck rather than like they just had one of the most blissful experiences of their lives. Hmm.
Well, then I guess this begs the question, if women want things to be different and if at least some doctors want things to be different, then how do things change?
Indeed, it's a very good question. One way is better information. Hospitals, as we saw from the shift away from even more barbaric practices like strapping women down, hospitals respond to consumer pressure. Because our system is a profit-driven system, when more mothers-to-be and dads-to-be seek out hospitals and doctors and alternative birthing centers, which in many ways are the best of both worlds, that really actively respect the right of moms and dads to not be processed down this road of interventions, that helps. And that's why I'm proud to say that many women and men who are expecting babies have been using my book to change practices, even quite far along in their pregnancies, to realize that if their caregivers are not respecting their questions, not respecting their right to know, it's a more profound problem than they initially thought it was. One of the things I discovered was that the way you're treated psychologically can have a physical effect on your labor. If a caregiver is rude to you, if a doctor pressures you, if someone is unkind to you, your labor shuts down. This is what I experienced. Even if you're told, if you don't produce that baby in 17 hours, we're going to section, your labor is likely to shut down. And so more and more women and men are reading my book and thinking, wow, you know what? I don't feel so comfortable with my obstetrician. And that I see now has a medical outcome for me and my baby. I'm going to change obstetricians. So that's one way to put pressure. Another way to put pressure is tort reform. Really, we need to reform the system so that doctors are not obliged to hook women up to monitors, even though they know it's dangerous for them, simply because it's the standard of care in their community. In other words, a doctor risks losing everything by not hooking a woman up to a monitor, even though he or she knows that it's risky for her to do so, because of the way the laws are now set up. So tort reform will really free doctors substantially to give women decent medical care.
Yeah, that you touched on that issue before, and I guess that was something that was in my mind. We talk about doctors and the way that they practice, that's something that lawsuits, malpractice suits, is something they have to be very concerned about, because it does seem to be in the society that we have now that if there's a bad outcome, and you know that there are going to be some, that there will be some folks that their first inclination is going to be, we're going to sue the doctor.
Well, yeah, but let's put it in context. I mean, we also live in a society in which, as one obstetrician told me just a few days ago, she understands why parents sue, because that's the only way they can get the wherewithal to look after the baby.
Mm-hmm.
But let's put it in a bigger context. Amazingly to me, midwives who respect their patient's right to know, who explain everything, and who don't make promises of what is not physically possible, which is, I mean, it is not physically possible to promise parents a perfect baby every time. You're safer, I discovered on doing research, giving birth at home than you are giving birth in hospitals. You're more likely to have a perfect baby if you are not subjected to these interventions. So it's not true that the interventions are safer. But what is amazing to me is that midwives who establish this context of trust with patients get sued far more rarely than obstetricians do. And I think that really also goes to how, again, just how traumatic the experience of giving birth under ordinary obstetrical circumstances can be, that there isn't that bond of trust. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you that it's a deeper problem.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Naomi Wolf. Her book, the one that we're talking about here, is in part about her experiences with pregnancy and motherhood and those of other women. The title of the book is Misconceptions, Truth, Lies, and the Unexpected on the Journey to Motherhood. It's published by Doubleday. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Another thing that I was really struck by in reading the book and is in your efforts to try to get information about, as you were talking with doctors and physicians, doctors and people who work in the hospitals, to try to find out what's likely to happen. It's difficult to get information on such a basic question as what's your C-section rate? You ask that of doctors, you ask that of hospitals, and they seemed not inclined to tell you.
Well, more than not inclined. I mean, in many ways, it really is, I hate to say it, but it really is a conspiracy. And it is a conspiracy to keep information from, you know, from women. Again, for profit motives. In only two states, and I don't think that's too strong a word when I explain exactly what I mean, it's literally impossible here in the Midwest to get information, accurate information about how many cesarean sections are done in the hospital where you are trying to, if you're trying to figure out which hospital to give birth in or which obstetrical practice to go with. They won't tell you the answer. I've had obstetricians calling me, you know, irate, but not yet one contradicting what I'm saying. And when I ask them, what is the cesarean section rate at your practice or your hospital, they do not tell me. They tell me things like, well, we don't have that data, or, you know, well, I can't get you accurate numbers, which is preposterous. I mean, they keep data on every billing, you know, address of every patient passing through so that they can get their fees. Of course, it's easy enough to collect the data on what the C-section rate is. But they don't want to tell you because there really is a conspiracy to keep the information from women so that women will not be choosing the hospital with the lowest cesarean rate, because that, you know, for the reasons I described earlier, it's in doctors' interest and hospitals' interest to feel like they have a free hand to do unnecessary cesareans. But it's really quite serious because in only two states are hospitals obliged to disclose, and it's what's even more serious to me is that women are told things that are not true and not accurate in order to manipulate them. For example, I know from having done the research that if you have amniocentesis, you've got a 1 in 200 chance of killing the baby, basically. I went to a presentation at a major New York hospital about amniocentesis, and I asked, you know, the spokeswoman, And there were 50 couples sitting there, all of whom were advised to have amniocentesis. What is the risk? And she said, oh, minuscule risk. You know, your baby might come out with a little scratch on its cheek from the needle. Now, that's just a lie. But the truth is, the forces behind that pressure and that sort of false disclosure were, it's in the hospital's interest to encourage everyone possible to have an amniocentesis, because it's in the hospital's best interest to never have a child brought to term that has a problem. But you're not given full information about what the risks are to your perfectly normal, healthy baby of having unnecessary tests like that. And I think that that's really immoral, that kind of manipulation of information. Again, ripping, tearing. Women are often told, oh, you're going to want an episiotomy rather than, as my first obstetrician put it, a jagged, bloody-edged tear to the anus, she said. And that is, believe me, that's going to terrify you. You're right. But the truth is that that's not statistically accurate. Statistically accurate is, if we do perineal massage, you will have a 6% chance of having an episiotomy, and a tear is likely to be much less serious than a major cut. So I do resent, that's why I so much resent books like What to Expect When You're Expecting, that do, I now know, condescend to women by not giving them complete information. It really treats women like children and suggests that they can't handle honest information.
We have a couple of callers here. I want to bring them into the conversation. Let's do that, starting with, I believe, a caller in Decatur on our toll-free line. This will be line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. I had a premature, 9-week-old premature baby 2 years ago, of which I had to have a cesarean because he was horizontal lie. Now, when they did the procedure, my physician told me that they were forced to do a small vertical incision as well as horizontal in the uterus. So therefore, if I have another baby, and I am pregnant now, mm-hmm. My risk would be a lot higher for rupture, and mm-hmm. he would suggest that I indeed do another C-section.
Yeah.
I just wanted your thoughts about that.
I mean, I'm not a specialist. I know there is strong controversy about the risks of repeat cesareans. I know there was one study that suggested that, in fact, there is a risk, but many midwives I've interviewed challenged the representative sample of that study. Here's what I would advise you to do.
Isn't it supposedly that if you have the horizontal, then you could conceivably go and do vaginal delivery afterwards, you know, mm-hmm. At a future date or whatever. But
right.
If you do have they used to do it vertically a long time ago, which was higher risk of rupture.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it does sound intuitively like with those two incisions you do have a higher risk of rupture. But I would strongly recommend for you to do is to not only consult your obstetrician, who, again, has a real vested interest mm-hmm. in not having you go through a trial of labor. And it's more of a vested interest than just avoiding rupture.
The obstetrician that's delivering my baby now is a different one because I have moved.
Uh-huh.
He is.
Why did you move?
My husband's job.
Oh, you physically moved. I see. I would strongly recommend that you also consult an alternative birthing center, because I know that many of the 400 alternative birthing centers, and you can find out more about them by contacting Midwife IM, that's Ina Mae Gaskin, midwifeim@aol.com.
Okay.
They often do give what are called VBACs, someone who wants a vaginal birth after a cesarean section, a trial of labor. And as long as you are backed up by a really good hospital, I would think that you should get, you know, both opinions to make up your mind about what the risks and benefits are of that. I'm sorry, I can't be more helpful.
Okay.
I do think it's interesting, though, you know, the reasons that obstetricians now automatically cut are reasons that are new. In other words, breech babies. Both of my babies were breech babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, midwives regularly deliver breech babies. There's a very easy position. They get you on what's called the Gaskin maneuver. They get you on your hands and knees, basically, and have a very high success rate in delivering breech babies. But obstetricians are no longer taught the manual skills of manipulating babies in, you know, very common, routine, quote-unquote, unusual positions, out. And so because most obstetricians have never been trained to see an ordinary birth, let alone an ordinary birth with anything, you know, not absolutely garden variety in the baby's presentation, they literally don't know how to deliver babies the way that old-fashioned family doctors used to know how to deliver babies, 50 years ago.
You're right. Right. Okay.
Good luck with the second birth. I hope you have a wonderful
day. Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to another caller here. This will be Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. My situation is somewhat similar to the first caller. I just recently found out that I'm pregnant, and this is going to be my second child. My question, though, is I did have some complications with my first child when he was being born. He was born 7 weeks premature, mm-hmm. and I was on bed rest for a couple weeks before that. Mm-hmm. First of all, what is your opinion as far as being put on bed rest if you are at risk for premature labor? Mm-hmm. And also, do you think it is still a safe idea to go to an alternative birthing center if you know that you are at a higher risk with your second child?
Mm-hmm. What was the reason for the complications? What was the reason for the bed rest that you're...
I was having premature contractions, and also I was already dilating at 35 weeks.
Yeah, so. I wouldn't mess with that, honestly. I mean, I know that those are serious. We don't want to have premature babies. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the message I want to give both you and the caller before is that, all evidence suggests that an alternative birthing center can safely deliver women who do not have high-risk conditions like preeclampsia, like diabetes, older mothers and, VBACs of the kind that, women who are trying to have vaginal birth after a first cesarean section, not of the kind that the first caller described.
Yeah, my first birth was a vaginal birth. I didn't have to have a cesarean section. But
I guess what I'm trying to say, I'm not a doctor, so I can't advise you on the specifics of this, except to say I would definitely consult an alternative birthing center and an independent childbirth educator, because all the studies now show that their outcomes are better than hospital outcomes for many, many conditions of labor and birth, and that the answers you're going to get are more objective in many ways. So I'm sorry that I can't be more helpful, but I really recommend that you get a second opinion from an independent birthing center, an independent childbirth educator.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
All right, let's go have another caller here on line number...
So I'm definitely feeling the lack of a medical degree with these two specialized and very important questions.
Well, it's funny. As I said, we have every month here, we've been doing a show on women's health with a local OBGYN, and we've been doing it for, gosh, I don't know how long, 20 years or something like that, 15, 17 years. And in fact, she was just here Monday, so I don't. She could have fielded these questions. Perhaps maybe there would be a reason the callers wouldn't want to ask her. I don't know.
Can I throw out a woman doctor? I'm sorry. Can I throw out a radical suggestion?
Sure.
It's great that you have an obstetrician, but it would be incredibly helpful for these listeners for you to have a midwife, because the obstetrical view of labor is a minority view. I mean, basically, from a midwifery perspective, obstetricians are great for the 17% of births in which there's a problem, but the problem is that they treat all low-risk births as if they're high-risk births. Mm. So, and they have the pressures on their answers that you've heard described earlier. So okay. I would really encourage you to think about that as another voice.
We can definitely do that. I think I have another caller here on line number two. Caller there? Yes.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes.
I worked as a labor and delivery nurse in Alaska, mm-hmm. and I do not agree with a lot of what you have said. I wish I was taking notes, but mm-hmm. I found that the doctors and the nurses both often had patients walking in the hallways. We tried to do pelvic rock. Mm-hmm. We did fetal monitoring, but as long as the lady wanted to be out of bed and wanted to be moving around, we sometimes used telemetry so that we could monitor the baby. Uh-huh. Sometimes we did monitoring 5 minutes per hour just mm-hmm. to have an idea of how things were going. Mm-hmm. I just really, really disagree with a lot of the things that you said. I do not take the attitude that obstetricians treat all deliveries as high risk. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying your experience is different from what the guest is talking about.
Yeah, very much so. And one thing that I haven't heard you say mm-hmm. is that with the rate of suing, Mm-hmm. There's a, until the child is 21 years of age, the parents can sue a nurse or a doctor for anything that happens during the birth. And until that child is 25 years of age, that child can sue.
Yes.
Makes a nurse want to be responsible and make good decisions mm-hmm. and take good care of that woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't determine whether or not they get out of the bed or not, but that does mean proper monitoring, proper charting,
mm-hmm.
so that if anybody comes back on that nurse or the doctor, mm-hmm. they have their records. And the idea
right.
of that there's too much monitoring and that they have everybody flat on their back in bed is mm-hmm. completely incorrect.
Okay, let me speak to each of your points. Thank you so much for the, you know, the passion that you obviously bring to this, and I'm sure you're a wonderful nurse, and I'm sure that your patients were lucky to have you. And I know that your patients were lucky to give birth in a hospital which is in the minority that does encourage women to move around. Most women who give birth in America do give birth in bed. If you look at the videos, the standard videos that are shown in birthing classes, the women are in bed. So I'm delighted that the hospital in Alaska is so progressive, and I applaud you completely. I'm glad you use telemetry. That's a way of monitoring the baby that lets women move around. But I also think you did confirm two things that are not so great, and you've added, you know, additional insight from your point of view. Obviously, if the pressure were not there on nurses and doctors, who I say with complete empathy could lose everything by a lawsuit for the quarter century that you just described that they're at risk after a baby is born, obviously they would practice medicine differently. You talked about proper monitoring. All the studies are in that show that there is no such thing as proper electronic fetal monitoring that is not telemetry. That means fetal monitoring where women are lying down strapped to a monitor, because the monitors have no proven benefit except as a legal defense. And they do, as I'm going to repeat, they do have the consequence of being much more likely to rush a woman into an unnecessary cesarean surgery. And with all respect, I really encourage you to look at misconceptions, because all the data is in. Mothers and babies are worse off with these interventions that are dictated by the pressures you just described. They are worse off. We are 18 out of 21 for bad outcomes for mothers and babies because of the risks attached to monitoring, attached to high cesarean section rates, attached to unnecessary epidurals, forceps delivery. And
what's your interpretation of, like, say, late decels? Consistent late decels on a fetal heart monitor strip. Does that not indicate distress of an infant, of a fetus?
All the data that is in indicates that the monitors are no better than chance at indicating a problem. And please understand, I totally support cesarean sections that are necessary. I just think that if we had a situation in America in which three times the number of heart surgeries were being done on men than were necessary, that would be a serious problem. Not to mention how much more difficult it is for new moms to take care of a little tiny baby under the circumstances that I described earlier, while still recovering from major organ surgery. I mean, one thing women are not told when they read what to expect is that a cesarean section is not minor surgery. You know, they take, in many practices, they take the uterus right out of your body. It is major organ surgery. It's not a, you know, a lifestyle choice the way it's presented in what to expect. And, yeah, I do think that you and your colleague would be better supported if you didn't have those legal swords hanging over your heads. Oh, let me ask you one question. What is the cesarean section rate in your hospital?
I don't remember. It was a high-risk hospital. It was the main hospital. It was in Anchorage, so it covered the whole state of Alaska
mm-hmm.
and also northern British Columbia and Canada. So we had a lot of high-risk stuff. And even though we had a lot of high-risk stuff, we still did not treat our low-risk pregnancies like they were high-risk.
I mean,
we saw the high-risk stuff all the time, and we were still able to be objective about it all.
I appreciate that, and let me tell you how much I appreciate your work and the hospital decision-making in that regard. At the same time, as a woman, as a mom, and as a feminist, I find it really distressing that you can't tell me, as a spokeswoman defending the hospital, what the cesarean section rate is. It's a simple number. to reach. I also want to tell you for your information that every time I've asked a spokesperson defending hospital practices what their cesarean section rate is, every single time routinely I've been told, oh, it's a high-risk hospital, it's a high-risk population. In fact, there isn't a hospital yet I've asked that of that didn't say, well, our numbers, the implication for listeners who are not sure what the stake here is, the numbers are artificially high because we deal with a high-risk population. It can't be that every hospital I've put this question to deals with a high-risk population that skews the numbers, and I do think your hospital, as fabulous as it sounds in many ways, owes it to your community to be able to tell people something as basic as what the chances are that they're likely to be sectioned.
I'm going to have to jump in here, and I hope the caller will forgive me because we're simply at the point where we're going to have to stop and we have some other people we can't take. There's one question, if you'll forgive me for asking it. It's just something that I've wondered for a long time. That I just want to ask real quick. And, you know, when Beauty Myth came out, we talked about it here on this show, and I'm sure you would not remember in all the interviews that you've done, but something that
I actually do remember.
Oh, sure, really? Well,
just due to style, yeah.
That's thoughtful. And I appreciate that. There's something I've always wondered. Mm-hmm. There was no picture of you on the book. Was that intentional, that your picture was left off? Yeah, Beauty Myth.
Oh, beautiful.
Your picture is on Misconceptions, and on most books, the picture of the author is there. I was just wondering whether, in fact, it was intentional on somebody's part that on Beauty Myth, there was no picture of you.
You know, it was 10 years ago. I honestly don't remember. I think it's possible that when the book came out in Britain, so much sort of pointless attention was paid to the picture that we made the decision to focus on the text. But subsequent, you know, the paperback has a picture,
okay.
Any author. Can I just say one thing,
sure.
Which we haven't gotten to,
sure.
Which is that, you know, a third of Misconceptions does have to do with what happens after you bring the baby home. And something we won't have a chance to get into, but it's a rich subject that readers are really responding to, is the shock of discovering, especially if you have a pretty balanced relationship, a pretty equitable relationship, the shock of discovering that once the baby comes home, these equitable relationships quickly revert to traditional relationships. And I do trace in detail the way the baby kind of acts as creates a kind of upheaval off in many marriages, in many relationships, that leaves new moms being startled and filled with, frankly, a lot of resentment at how what they thought was their balanced partnership turns into a traditional arrangement. And I track where that resentment goes and how it plays out. And I have a mother's manifesto at the end, which is really for mothers and fathers, about how we can create a movement, really a political lobby, to give moms and dads the kind of social change they need so that family life will not be strained by the arrival of a new baby, but will actually be better supported.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
Our guest, Naomi Wolf, and again, the title of the book, if you'd like to read it, is Misconceptions, Truth, Lies, and the Unexpected on the Journey to Motherhood. It is out now. It's published by Doubleday.